Question: how could you recognize rock critic Ken Tucker at a stadium concert? Answer: he's the one reading a book. Reviewing stadium concerts was never what Ken liked best about being a rock critic. Today we find out more about Ken as part of our continuing series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors. I wanted to know what the first rock record was that he liked well enough to buy.
It was the Beach Boys, the Sloop John B. I don't know why. It had nothing to do with my life. I think the fact that this boat, it took me, I think, weeks to even figure out it was a boat. That's probably what it was. It was sort of like the I Am the Walrus for me. I had to try and figure out the lyric. But I like the harmonies. I like the Beach Boys. I don't know. It's, in retrospect, it seems like rather a bland choice. But that was I can remember the little jacket, the picture of the Beach Boys looking very solemn on the little sleeve of the 45 of Sloop John B.
Did you have a lot of odd jobs so you can make money to buy records?
No, I wasn't in fact allowed to buy records that much. My father was like very strict about this growing passion. I could buy like one record a week or a month or something. I remember suffering. Suffering terribly under these constraints for some reason in retrospect.
So if you weren't allowed to buy records, you probably listened to the radio a lot.
That's right. Yeah, the radio was really it. I remember having a radio that was much, we didn't in those days have Walkman, but I remember having a small portable radio that I would literally take to bed with me and fall asleep listening to, sort of pressed up against my ear. And it was like everything from, I grew up in Connecticut, so I got all these New York stations. So I'd listen to Cousin Brucey and WMCA Good Guys on the one hand, and then sort of switch over to WOR and catch Gene Shepherd, and that sort of really liking radio a lot.
Was rock and roll always a part of your life, or did you discover it at some age?
I think I discovered it because it really wasn't sort of part of the atmosphere of my household. I never went to a rock concert until I was doing it professionally, believe it or not.
Wow.
It just was one of those things where between money and discipline, I just didn't go. So I think that was one reason it became such a passion for me when I got to about college age, was suddenly I was out of the house. I could do what I wanted to. So it was even more of a sort of secret passion.
Since this was your great escape going to college and you finally could buy records and go to concerts, no parental restrictions, you had access to the city, did you really go crazy for a while?
I led this incredibly dissolute existence. I was like down in Washington Square Park lying on the stone benches sleeping. No, not at all. In fact, at the beginning of my college life, it was just the opposite. I was entering some awful teenage arty phase. And what I was really doing was writing poetry. And so
there used to be a lot of this that went around.
That's right. And so what I wanted to do, my idea I remember at the time, was not so much rock and roll in entering the city, but was that I was going to go emulate Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery and all these poets that I admired so much. But fortunately, sort of the times exactly coincided in a peculiar way with my interests, because that was the same time that people like Patti Smith, who was at that time a poet, was setting her poetry to music, suddenly had Lenny Kaye beside her strumming an electric guitar. So in a funny way, it led me back into rock and roll.
When you were starting to write about rock, this was in the 70s?
Mm-hmm.
Mid-70s?
That's right.
So it was more or less around the time when the punk scene was developing in New York.
Yeah.
You'd mentioned Patti Smith. Did you cover that a lot? Did you go to the clubs a lot?
Yeah, that was really a time when I really started. I mean, as a professional critic, you tend to be sent to the big acts, so that I would go to Madison Square Garden and see major acts if I got an assignment. But then the punk scene was something you pursued on your own, so it became even more exciting to go down to the Village to CBGBs and to small clubs and see Television and the Ramones and Blondie and all those bands that were just coming up, and see Talking Heads and David Byrne being even more awkward looking than he is now, if that can be believed, up on stage. And that really was exciting. And it was something that was sort of all around you at the time. It was something that everybody was talking about, and it was something you wanted to be in on the ground floor of. So that was a real exciting period.
How did you come to see the role of rock critic?
Well, I came to see it as a sort of bridge to the reader in terms of providing not only a consumer guide service, which you did have to say, you know, whether you should buy this record or not, but also providing some sort of sense of history, some sort of sense of context, and making it as lively and immediate as possible. I didn't see this sort of I think now rock criticism is a lot of consumer guide service, that most of it is. Buy this record, don't buy that one. And I think it's gotten to a point where it's sort of the Siskel and Ebert influence that's extended into rock and roll.
In the later part of the 70s, you moved to Los Angeles to write for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. You were the rock critic there. And that was about the time that the hardcore bands were getting, were performing in Los Angeles.
That's right.
What kind of scene were you covering in Los Angeles? Did you go to those clubs at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was also a big, I mean, Los Angeles was such a city of contrast that on the one hand, it was the center of the music industry, I think even more so than New York, although lots of record companies are based on both coasts. Los Angeles is such a showbiz town, having both the movie industry and the rock and roll industry there. And so the big acts were the very biggest, glitziest, showiest acts imaginable. And this ended up breeding at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, this incredibly bitter, turned in on itself rock scene that was full of people who wanted to make themselves as ugly as possible, as obnoxious as possible, as violent as possible. I mean, the standard idea for most of these acts was to scare the wits out of any major label A&R man that could possibly come to scout them. And a lot of these bands accepted it almost as like an artistic statement, that we'll make our statement for 6 months and we'll disband. We're not in it for record company contracts and royalties. We're in it to make a point and then disappear.
When you were going to those clubs and there was a slam dancing, which people would knock into each other and people would say, be spitting onto the performers on stage or throwing things onto stage, how did you feel? Because you weren't part of that that part of the scene or anything.
No, I would spit verbally through my writing, through the cutting edge of my prose is how I spit. But I could understand the impulse. I mean, these guys didn't have access that I had.
In the early 1980s, you moved to Philadelphia to write about rock for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And at the Inquirer, you ended up going to a lot of stadium concerts.
That's right. Yeah, I think the 80s saw that sort of, again, rock as big showbiz. It was a time when I began to feel sort of disaffected from that sort of stadium mentality. Even something like Live Aid, a huge phenomenon like that, I thought did a disservice to the musicians in the sense of the concerts being so huge, so massive, the bills of acts so large that each act could only perform, say, two or three songs and they were off the stage. I mean, it certainly as a philanthropic gesture, it was very nice. But as an artistic event, I thought it was really lacking in something.
You, fairly recently, within the past year, you transferred at the Inquirer from writing about rock to writing about television. Mm-hmm. Had you gotten alienated from newspaper rock criticism?
Yeah, to a great extent, that's true. I think that in general, newspapers around the country are much more tied in these days to the idea of let's get the big star interview. I think in general, that kind of that USA Todayization of newspapers of let's have the biggest names, let's write short stories, let's make everything positive. Everything has to be positive instead of providing some real sense of proportion that I just find very frustrating in a lot of ways.
You had spent so much of your adult life writing about rock for newspapers. Did it take you a long time to really admit to yourself that you not only wanted to make a change, but that you were really going to try to do it?
Yeah, I think so, although I'd sort of been prepared for it, and I think in moving over to television, it was another pop culture form that I felt very comfortable with.
Do you worry that when your children grow up that, oh God, they might have bad taste in music?
Yes, I do. to some extent, I hope they like not necessarily what I like, but that they take an interest in it enough to sort of separate the junk from the good stuff on whatever sort of level of taste that they develop. My biggest fear is that they'll end up liking a kind of music that I know very little about. That they'll suddenly become Mozart freaks, and I'll have to sort of do a lot of hasty catching up. That's about the only fear I have at this point.
Well, Ken, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker. We come on this loop, John B. My grandfather and me. Around Nassau town we did roam. Drinking all night. Got into a fight. Well, I feel so broken. is Fresh Air.